welcome to EI Talks, where you join us live from deepest Sweden at the Engelsberg Seminars. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and today my guest is Iskander Rehman, who is Axon Johnson Fellow at the Kissinger Center in Washington, D.C., and a specialist in foreign and defense policy. But recently, Iskander has been focusing on strategy, particularly in the early modern era. And he's preparing a book on three French statesmen, three distinguished and famous to most of you French statesmen, Sully, Richelieu, and perhaps the most interesting, as far as I'm concerned, because of his relationship with Oliver Cromwell, is Mazarin. Now, can you introduce those three figures to us, please, Iskander?
Sure, absolutely. It's a delight to be here and to be on the show. So three larger-than-life characters who all played a key shaping role in reforging French military and diplomatic power in the wake of the Wars of Religion, and in helping France achieve a position on the European continent whereby it gradually displaced Spain as the leading hegemon.
And we're looking here predominantly at the 17th century.
So we're basically looking at the period going from the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572, but that's when I start the narrative, when Sully, at the age of 12, he's a Huguenot in Paris, narrowly survives the massacre, and then his subsequent life and career as a lead minister to Henry IV of France, to the Peace of the Pyrenees, which you will be very intimately familiar, of course, with your work on Cromwell, which was negotiated in 1659 and sort of formalized in 1660.
And so can you tell us something about those three statesmen? Just give us a mini biography of each so that those who aren't familiar with their work will get a grasp of them.
Sure. So Sully was first and foremost a consummate warrior and soldier, and that's how he actually identifies himself in many ways throughout his memoirs, who are a fascinating account of the era that used to be widely read, including in England in the 19th century, because his memoirs were considered to be a vital resource. He spent much of the Wars of Religion fighting in the armies of Henry of Navarre, who later became Henry IV of France. During Henry IV's reign, he was elevated to a series of ministerial positions, the most important being a superintendent of finances, but he was also the convoyeur de France, so in charge of all the major infrastructural projects that took place in France during that time. There was a period of reconstruction and recentralization after the Wars of Religion. He was also the Grand Master of Artillery, and he played a key role in modernizing and standardizing what became a veritable service arm of the French army at the time. He played a very important role as a sort of intra-factional intermediary, because even though he himself was a Huguenot, a Protestant, he had many close friends and indeed family members who were Catholic, so he was very useful to Henry IV in that regard, as he sort of trying to unify a fractured nobility around him. So a man of many hats, and even though he wasn't the chief minister per se, because Henry IV, unlike Louis XIII, his successor, preferred to have a more of a sort of team of rivals approach to governing with three or four lead ministers, he gradually became the most influential, bulldozing his way into almost every aspect of government affairs, including foreign policy. He eventually, after the assassination of Henry IV, he stayed on a little bit, a few months on during the regency of Marie de Medici, Henry IV's widow, but he was known for being a particularly difficult character, having a foul temper, being very proud, and of course, over the preceding years, he had stepped over many colleagues' toes, and they were only too happy now that Henry IV, his great protector and close friend, was dead to sort of see the back of him. So he was eventually forced into retirement. And what's quite astonishing is that he spends the next 30 years, he only died at the age of 82, the next 30 years in forced retirement in his castles along the Loire. Occasionally there are rumors that he might be allowed to go back into government in some capacity, and his hopes get rekindled only for the door to be slammed back in his face. And during those 30 years of forced retirement, which are quite sad, really, because he's sort of powerlessly commenting on the ebb and flows of French foreign policy while also dealing with all these family problems, as his son is sort of hopeless wastrel who ends up suing his dad for more money. He has a very difficult relationship with his grandchildren. Richelieu, who later becomes chief minister, despises him. So he's a very sort of isolated figure by the end of his life. But he does use that opportunity to write his memoirs. Mm-hmm. What worked in his favour is that he simply outlived nearly all his contemporaries and potential critics.
No.
So
that contingent element is always important.
Yes.
It's a long life.
Yes. So there are aspects of them that are now deemed to be notoriously unreliable, if not embellishments. But of course, at the time, he had no real survivors to contradict him. He was then the second figure that I examined in the book is Cardinal Richelieu.
He's probably the most famous of the three, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Largely thanks to Alexandre Dumas,
of course,
the Three Musketeers.
Yeah.
We're all familiar with Steve Curry's mustachio twirling villain. A fascinating and, of course, much more complex character, I think, than is traditionally portrayed. And he was chief minister under Louis XIII from 1624 to his death in 1642. Mm-hmm. And he is traditionally considered, and I think rightly so, to be perhaps the greatest of the three statesmen that I'm examining, at least in terms of his the vast and brooding nature of his intellect, so the sophistication of his foreign policy, etc., mm-hmm. etc. And then last but not least comes Mazarin, who led a particularly fascinating, picaresque sort of existence. He was born in Italy, Giulio Mazarini, and he started his career as a papal soldier and then diplomat. He met Richelieu at the negotiating table during the War of Mantuan Succession in the 1630s, which opposed France and Spain in northern Italy, and he was part of the papal team trying to negotiate a peace in between the two powers.
I should say, Skander, on a personal note, the War of the Mantuan Succession is rarely a child's entry into history, at least if they're from Britain anyway. But there was a wonderful series during the 1960s and 1970s. I think it was made in the 60s and broadcast in the 1970s, through to the 1980s, called The Flashing Blade, which was a French historical drama made for children. And it was set in the War of the Mantuan Succession. It was the first time I'd ever heard of Richelieu, even before The Three Musketeers. Tears, actually.
Really?
And it is, I recommend it to anyone. I'm sure you could. It's on YouTube all the time. It has the most magnificent, exciting music and opening credits as well. But I digress.
No. I'm very excited now. I'm obviously going to have to watch this after my research process, of course. Mazarin. Something of a flamboyant, charismatic character. I don't know if they show his appearance in the TV show, but he became famous or notorious, one might say, for galloping in between the French and Spanish armies just before they were entered into combat, shouting "Pace, pace, peace" in Italian, and waving his hat, and managing to put an end to what would have been a cataclysmic struggle. So he meets Richelieu. They are both very taken with one another, a sort of embryonic bromance forms, one might say. Mazarin states later that he was just in awe of the sheer power of will and intellect of Richelieu. Richelieu seems to have found him charming, amusing, one of the few people he genuinely enjoyed spending time with, and gradually begins to lure him into France's orbit. presses for him to be nominated as the papal nuncio to Paris, and then eventually he is offered letters of naturalization, becomes French, Mazarini becomes Mazarin, and he manages to very craftily make his way to the apex of power upon Richelieu's death, even though Richelieu reportedly on his deathbed, this is maybe an apocryphal tale, but reportedly told Louis XIII that he should keep Mazarin in his employ because, I quote, Mazarin had a mind sufficient to govern four empires. It's not clear if there was any sort of clear line of ministerial succession put in place, but nevertheless, Mazarin, largely through his charm and his close relationship with the Queen Anne of Austria, Louis XIII dies a few months after Richelieu, manages to become chief minister. And he remains in that position until his death in 1661.
Mm. Now, what I'm intrigued by about this, because obviously you've built this career in foreign and defense policy based in Washington. You've had major contacts with the U.S. government, who's obviously a major player, the major player in terms of foreign policy. And as a fellow early modern historian, it always intrigues me as to how you apply this. I'm slightly suspicious of the term applied history.
Sure.
But how does this inform these activities in the 16th and 17th centuries? How do you apply them today? What resonances are there for you? What lessons, if that's the right word?
Yes, so I think that's a great question. One of the reasons why I began to work more and more on this period, including in some studies that were commissioned by the U.S. Department of Defense, actually, on Richelieu and his grand strategy during the 30 Years' War, was because I just felt that this was a period that was either grossly simplified, misunderstood, or simply not well known amongst contemporary U.S. policymakers. This is not to say that U.S. policymakers don't have an appetite for history. In fact, from experience, I argue that there is a huge hunger for more accessible military and diplomatic history.
That's my perception too.
Yes. Huge hunger in history, and that, of course, is not really provided by much of the security studies literature, which remains heavily dominated by American-style political science in the United States. The problem is that I think traditionally there has been an almost exclusive focus on more recent periods of history, so history of the Second World War, history of the Cold War, obviously, history of World War I, maybe to a certain extent the 19th century, the Civil War, of course, is a very important moment in American military history. But there was a sort of vast gulf in between, or sort of huge gaping space in between Thucydides, who is still widely read, and the 19th century, where not much was being explored. And when people do talk about the early modern era, it's usually about the so-called Westphalian movement.
Which we've been talking about here.
Yes, exactly. Which is often somewhat grossly simplified, I'm sure you would agree, as a historian of the period, as being the moment when all of a sudden the modern state system seemingly emerged and we moved towards a sort of more coolly rationalized, secularized form of statecraft, which I'm sure you would agree is grossly anachronistic.
Somewhat simplistic.
Yes, so I think the early modern era, and especially the Franco-Spanish rivalry, at a period when U.S. security managers, foreign policy intellectuals, are thinking more and more deeply about the resurgence of great power rivalry, and more specifically the U.S.-China rivalry, I think it holds just so many instructive parallels, lessons, insights, whether it's on great power rivalry, industrial policy, trade wars and tariffs, and of course, as you know, were a huge part of European geopolitics at the time, the interweaving of more naked geopolitical interests with complex ideological and confessional goals.
And one thing that you really concentrate on is information, which obviously has parallels with then and now.
Yes, absolutely.
So what would they be, do you think? I mean, what about that first great information technological revolution? I mean, does that tell us anything about the one we're undergoing at the moment?
Yes, I think it does. We live in an era of abundance and distraction, of shrinking attention spans, content shock, people call it, seemingly endless quantity over elusively finite quality. And since the advent of the internet, it appears that we've never had access to so much information, and yet somehow we appear to be less collectively well-read, or that's what the data shows us. People read less books every year, more prone to disinformation, more intellectually febrile, fragmented, and jittery. We're all familiar with the depressing scientific data that our hyper-connected brains are being suddenly rewired by those synthetic appendages that are our cell phones.
No, well, there's one thing that that I've always thought a parallel when I was writing book about Cromwell's Protectorate was the similarity between the Calvinist concepts of predestination and Twitter anxiety that I always thought was there. So, for example, anyone who's familiar with Calvinist idea of predestination, it is the idea that, you know, God created the world at the beginning and, you know, chose the saints and the sinners at the same time. So, you know, you would be, if you were damned, you were damned at the beginning of the world and there was nothing you could ever do about it. And similarly, if you were one of the saved, there was nothing you could do about it. And so you were constantly looking for signs that you were one of the saved, that you were one of the good guys who was going to have this blissful eternal life. And I think there's something about Twitter when people are getting the response and they get the heart on Twitter for a statement they've made. And there's a horrible of anxiety when people use social media. You know, do people like me? Do people not like me? Am I doing the right thing? Am I on the side of the angels? You know, that's exactly it. So I thought that was certainly one. When you talk about jittery, that's exactly it.
Absolutely. Yes. And then, of course, there is the fact that despite all our latent anxieties when it comes to dealing with this seemingly overwhelming abundance of information, cognitive overload, etc. These concerns, in fact, as you know, are not all that new. Mm-hmm. And in the early modern era, we have a lot of accounts of thinkers, statesmen, trying to grapple with technological advances like the creation of the printing press, the rediscovery of lost classics, and just this sheer abundance of information that it was extremely difficult for them to integrate and absorb. And then, of course, with the development of the early modern states and its sophisticated bureaucratic apparatus, just the sheer volume of communications and dispatches. We know, for example, that Philip II of Spain, often called Rey Papalero, the king of paperwork, on one year might have to deal with 18,000 petitions to his desk. Yeah. I mean, Richelieu, for example, who I'm obviously reading a lot about at the moment, behind this sort of wintry and steely exterior that we're more familiar with, he in fact is often a neurotic mess. He's just drowning in work, suffering from migraines. Occasionally he had to lie down on the floor of his office and dictate to his secretaries because he couldn't no longer stand with his migraines. And a large part of this was due to cognitive overload. So our era may not be that unprecedented as we think.
And this is one of the reasons, of course, why we should be studying early modern history.
Yes.
Yeah. So when can we look forward to this study of these three great French statesmen?
So I think I have probably about the optimistic side of me would say 8 to 9 months of writing left. The realistic side, maybe closer to 11. And then hopefully I found a good publisher, or a good publisher has found me, sometime after that.
Well, I look forward to it greatly, and thank you for coming to AI Talks. Thank you, Scanlon.
Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you.